What's up, everyone, and welcome to The Corporate Bartender. You are all in for a treat today. Some conversations are great, and then there's this one. We are so excited to have Charlie Gilkey on the program today. Never heard of Charlie? Well, buckle up. You're going to want to take some notes. We're talking about teams and the team habits that will transform your work life. Consider this pearl of wisdom. You cannot have a high-performing team without high belonging. I know. That's the kind of thinking that's going to transform your work teams. Come along for the ride, won't you? Charlie is a business author, speaker, coach, and entrepreneur specializing in leadership, teamwork, and productivity. He's also the author of the new book, Team Habits, How Small Actions Lead to Extraordinary Results. The hits keep coming, and you all know what I'm going to say. This has been my favorite conversation of 2024. It was amazing. Bartender Nation, I think you're all going to dig it. Buckle up, DC Beers, grab your favorite cocktail, and let's get right on into it with Charlie Gilkey on today's TCB.
Welcome to Sky Teams, the Corporate Bartender, where we gather some of the best HR and people leaders to discuss what's happening on the people side of business. Now pull up a stool, belly up to the bar, and join us for the Corporate Bartender.
Awesome. Well, Lori, what do you think? Should we get going?
Let's do it.
Let's get on into it. All right. Well, welcome, everybody. It is good to see you all. It is your favorite day and mine. It's Wednesday. You know what that means. It is Corporate Bartender Day. It is the 24th of January, January 2024. It's almost over. We're 1/12 of the way through the year that I can't even believe is already here. It is the, Ruby's giving it a big fat thumbs down. It is the 187th time that we have convened this group of awesome people. Today's going to be a fun day. We have a guest, as I like to say. He's the one that you do not recognize in your displays of the Brady Bunch variety. His name is Charlie Gilkey. He is an author, speaker, coach, an entrepreneur specializing in leadership, teamwork, and productivity. And he has a new book out called Team Habits, How Small Actions Lead to Extraordinary Results. And we're going to get into what that means today. One of my favorite fun facts about Charlie is he's also a philosopher. So if you have questions about Kant or any of your favorite philosophers, you can lay them on Charlie in the Q&A. We've got a bunch of upcoming guests. They just keep coming, guys, and they're so fun. On the 31st, so next week, we've got Marcia Acker. She's the author of Build Your Model for Leading Change. And this book is really cool. It's a workbook for doing change on a team. And I think it's pretty interesting. I've been playing around with some of the exercises in it. I'm looking forward to chatting with her about that. After that, After that, we've got on February 14th, Amber Ontiveros. She's the author of Heal the Four Woundings, A Guide to End Discord and Discrimination. That's a fun one. Looking forward to that. Skipping it into March, because Ruby and I've got a bunch of travel coming up, and I think February and into March, we're gone most weeks, so Wednesdays will be sparse. 20th of March, we have Robin Bolton. She is a she's an innovator, and her whole angle is about innovation. And it was interesting because I get these pitches from all these PR companies all the time, and this person sent a note in saying, you should talk to Robin. And I'm like, well, why? She's not really relevant to my audience. And then she sent me three podcasts that she did about innovation in the people side of the business. And I'm like, okay, we will talk to Robin then. That sounds fantastic. All right, but today it's all about Charlie. Charlie Gilkey is here. As I mentioned, he's a business author, speaker, coach, entrepreneur. His gig is leadership, teamwork, and productivity. And his new book, you can see here on the screen, Team Habits, How Small Actions Lead to Extraordinary Results. We did not warn him that on The Bartender, we have an atypical, rather unorthodox way of bringing people onto the show. We dance them on, Charlie. So let's give Charlie a big, warm TCB welcome, shall we? There it is. I love it when the guest dances along as well.
Look, before leading up to this book, I was like, I'm just going to practice my Ellen dance just in case. Right? Just in case that happens, I want to be prepped for that.
You know, no one has ever, they've never made that parallel to the Ellen dance.
That's true.
That's pretty darn fantastic. So I'm pretty stoked about that. Charlie, thanks for being here with us today. It's good to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Well, we always like to start, before we get into anyone's content, we always like to start with, how did you even get here? So you're a pretty successful guy. You're an author. You're a speaker. You're a coach. I don't imagine that when you were a tiny baby, you said, that's what I want to be when I grow up. I want to be that guy and a subject matter expert on how to run better teams. So tell us, how did you get here?
Well, like the famous Steve Jobs quote, like, I could see the dots going backwards, but I couldn't see them going forwards, right? And so it's obvious when you look at my background how I would end up here, but it was not obvious to me at the time. So I grew up, my dad was in the Army, so and six or seven of his siblings were also in the military. Right. So I grew up from that space, got involved in Boy Scouts, leading troops, leading scout troops, right? Scouts and being involved in different things related there, like as early as six.
Wow.
Started teaching at summer camps, leading expeditions, doing all that, got put in accelerated leadership or like young leaders, groups and things like that. But, you know, I have to say this, and yeah, I'm going to kick it off this way because that's how we do things. Like where I grew up in the South. And when I grew up, people like me were not the obvious leaders. They did not look like me, right? And so part of the reason I didn't see it coming is because when I watched and looked, it was like, we had like Colin Powell, we had a few people. I'm thankful that there are a lot more people that look like me that are in leadership positions, but that's partially why I didn't see it coming.
Right.
Despite going through all of these governor schools and, you know, the senators, like all of that sort of stuff. I also went to West Point when I was in, after high school, decided that was not for me, ended up going back into the Army after college, became an officer. So I deployed in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom, ended up in company command. While I was working towards completing my PhD in philosophy, which you already mentioned, Eric. Got out of both of those, the academic philosophy route and also the military, because I knew this way of being in the world was me being at my fullest and best, right? I got to apply all the different things. And so depending upon how you count, so I'm 43 today, you know, I've either got like 35 years of leadership or, you know, go back to when I was 22. Like you can go back to those times. So I've been doing this for a long time. So to answer your question, it's now obvious looking back why I would write a book on building and running teams, but it was not at all obvious when I was going through it. I fell into most of this backwards.
As most of us do, right? Right. We sort of fall into the thing that we do. What was it specifically, Charlie, about teams that grabbed you and said, man, I got a thing to share and I need people to know this?
Okay. So team habits is a Trojan horse for a few things, right?
Okay.
And so I'm gonna tell everyone here what the Trojan horses are. It's a systems book, one, right? So if you look underneath everything we're talking about, it's actually about systems. And it's a book about power. I did not want to write a book about power, but you can't talk about teams and teamwork and work without talking about power.
Yep.
Why teams are so important to me is because when I'm working with my clients who are, you know, executives or owners, and I see so many of the issues that they're coming with, the fundamental flaw that they have is they're stuck in thinking about individuals doing individual things. And they're not thinking about how that team as a system, as a unit is operating and how that system operates within the larger organization. And so too many people end up in HR offices thinking that they've got a people problem or person problem, when in fact they have a organizational workways problem or they have team habits problems that they need to solve. And so it just was one of those things like, why am I the dumb one here that is missing that? Like, am I the weirdo? But when I come in and solve so many problems, right, and work with organizations, it's really how do we build better teams? And if we focus on team, and I want to pause here, because when I say team in this conversation, I mean the 4 to 8 people that you spend 80% of your time working with.
Okay.
So your department of 35 people, it's a team, but not really. It's a group, right? Mm-hmm. It's too big to be a team and it falls apart. But what's important is in that team, and I'm going to use myself, Eric, Lori, and Ruby on the, for the rest of the call for these purposes, you know those people. They are not some random people you have nothing to do with. And usually you either like them or you care about them as humans. Usually you know they're doing their best.
Yep.
And yet when we start thinking, I hear this a lot, I'm sure HR folks hear this a lot, my team does this, my team does that. And I'm like, it's Eric, Lori, and Ruby. Who are you talking about? Right? Who's my team here? Like, let's go into that. And so many of the things and challenges, the bumps that we face at work can be and should be handled at the team level. Because if you spend 80% of your time working with these people, if you make that team better, then most of your work is going to be better. There's always going to be, you know, whatever person walks in and does whatever they do, whether they're an executive or whether they're just a troll in your organization, there's going to be that. But that's in the 20% of your engagement, mm-hmm. not the 80%. And so too few people take seriously the power that they have with their team to make work better, which means making life better for those 4 to 8 people.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's interesting too. There's a bit of recent McKinsey research that we quote a lot in workshops that we do about the sort of disproportionate impact that managers or leaders of teams have on not only the quality of the work life of the people that are in that core team, but the quality of their entire lives. They have a really disproportionate impact there. And I don't think a lot of people, especially newer managers, appreciate that fully. Mm-hmm. So before we get into your frameworks, I wanted to ask a question because we see this a lot, mm-hmm. right? We work with a lot of technology-oriented companies. Mm-hmm. And not to say that this doesn't happen in finance or marketing, or it does. Say I'm a really good employee. I'm a really good doer of stuff. I'm a fantastic software developer, just a crack code jockey. And as a reward for being so good at my job, I am given a job for which I am not qualified.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of don't even want.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a promotion. It's how you, that's Zoom. Thanks for the balloons, for my gestures for balloons there. Yeah. It's kind of like this. I want to rock. Now it's not going to do it.
Ruby gets
there it.
It
is. Ruby's rocking.
you achieved your allotment of, of background stuff. So that's there right. you go.
So I'm given this job that I'm not qualified to do, I may not be super into. And the expectations are that because I was so good at doing the thing that I did, that I will naturally be gifted in this job. Mm-hmm. So the expectations around team performance don't drop when that happens. Mm-hmm. The expectations stay elevated. And I've worked with so many folks who are terrified when they get into this job because they have no idea what to do. You mentioned it's not a people problem, it's a systems issue. Like, I don't even know that there are systems, right? 2 weeks ago, I was writing code and I was getting paid and rewarded for writing really good code. And now I'm out of my league. What advice do you have for those new team leaders facing that dilemma?
Interestingly, that's the next new body of work that I'm working on. And I call them accidental managers, right? Didn't want to do it. Wasn't on the pipeline, but here they are. So you're the manager now, right? And so when I say systems, I just mean a set of interconnected agents that have an impact upon each other, right? So the first thing that I would say to that accidental manager is you're probably in the 70 to 80% of majority of accidental managers that get tapped this way. Mm-hmm. This is the norm and will be the norm for a long time. So that's thing one. Two, it's completely understandable that you don't know what you're doing. Okay. Like, you weren't trained for this. This was not your arc. Three, this is a figure outable problem. And four, you don't have to do it alone.
Yeah.
If you try to do it alone, you will likely fail. Mm-hmm. Right. That is both the blessing and the curse here. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, obviously I would say I pick up my book, because if you really work on some of these things, your team will actually, like, your job. Okay, let me pause. There's a book out there called It's the Manager, which actually irritates me. It's a good book, but I don't like the title. Okay. Right. And here's why I don't like the title. Because it does yet again the job of fixing this system on one person. It's the manager. It's the manager's responsibility. By implication, it also means it's not everyone else.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
Because that's the inference, right?
That's the inference. It's the manager. Yeah. And so accidental managers hear messages like that. And it's like, oh, crap. It's me. I've got to figure this out. I don't know what I'm doing. Now I've got six people's jobs who depend on me. What the hell do I do? Okay. First off, if it's the manager, it's because the manager works on the system that is their team and works with the system that is their team. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's start there. I would then say a slew of other things, but one of those is like, look, if you really want to come in, stop the labeling of whether you're a leader or a manager or whether, like, that's not helpful, right? Look at your team and say, okay, what are the things that I think we can change and do better? Have the courage to speak up with your team about those things to build some consensus and alignment. And then actually allocate some time to doing the change work to change those things. In my world, I open the book with a broken printer, which most of you all will know here, right? Not the metaphor, but you've experienced this before. Every organization I've ever consulted and worked with has a broken printer that everybody knows about, that no one fixes.
Don't send your job to that one. It doesn't work.
Yeah, don't send your job to that one, except for you forget to toggle it sometimes, and then you do. And then it does what the broken printer does and screws your life up and your team's life up. That's right. Right. Because it's just sitting there. And so sometimes they've been around so long, they got like employee numbers, like employee number 48, right? It's just been printer. Around that long where it's got names. And the funny thing about it is when you really get to it, a broken printer, a real broken printer, is at most a $500 decision that someone can make in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And we don't.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right. But if it's not real broken printers, it's all the other little small things like that in which teams like just accept the absurdity of the waste and friction in their team, mm-hmm. right? So for the accidental manager, what I would say is, look, fix a broken printer within the first 30 days, right? Because if nothing else, mm-hmm. it shows, okay, I am going to come in and at least try. I might not fix everything. I am going to at least try to make our lives a little bit better, mm-hmm. right? Versus the common thing that people will do, and I think many accidental managers fall down with this one, is you're like, okay, I'm going to come in and I'm going to spend 90 days just assessing things.
Right, listening
to everything. By the time you're 90 days into it, you've already accepted the normal of the absurdity.
Mm-hmm. All that bad norming, right?
All that bad norming. You're just like, okay, employee number 48, check. Right. And you just go down and you don't even see those things. Right.
And your missed opportunity is an office space, like out of office experience, where everybody gets to beat up employee number 48.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, but what I would say is the approach that I would want you to take to fixing that broken printer is not you as the lord of all new things that is the manager.
Mm-hmm.
Fix it. I would say, hey, team, what's up with employee number 48? Everybody's like, oh, well, I don't know. It's just kind of here. Like, we hate it. No one does anything. It's like, okay, let's get rid of it. And then get rid of it or figure out what to do with it. And it seems like, oh, well, but also there's this other thing. And then there's this other thing. And then you can just go around, like, actually with your team building that type of consensus. Because what that does, I know I'm unpacking a lot here. What that does is there will come a time in which someone's like, oh, yeah, there's this other thing. Mm-hmm. And you can say to them, well, what are your ideas on fixing it? We know we can fix things.
Yeah.
What would you do?
And I think that's one of the huge things I see with those rock star individual contributors moving into very uncomfortable territory is they want to double down on what they're comfortable with. I'll do it. I'll fix it. I'll do it. Right. I'll do the thing. Nope. Got it. Good. Right. And it feels like they're being supportive of the team. But then you set up this expectation of the team of, well, I guess, you know, Ruby's job is just to make everything awesome for us. So we're just going to sit back and just start complaining about things and then she'll make it awesome for us. Right. And then you just run out of gas or you realize that, whoops, that actually isn't my whole job.
Well, and that's the bit of context for the accidental manager, Eric, that you didn't put on is we've also adopted the norm in the modern management of the working manager, which means do all of the individual tasks and then you get this add-on of management on top of that. And people don't realize that's a relatively new way of norming what a manager's job is. It was not like that 25, 30 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was. Someone can tell me otherwise. I wasn't in the workforce. But I remember that there were managers that actually had more of their time, managers and executives that had more of their time just on the people management side of things. And they weren't expected to be coders most of the time and then squeeze in the manager stuff, right?
And that is the exact right word, squeeze in, which means half the time, don't do it all.
Yeah, half the time because we are humans, you are going to go back to the last thing that made you successful.
That's right.
Of course.
Which is solving that. And so, Lori, what I end up telling a lot of people, and when I'm an executive coach for accidental managers, which can be people who've managed for a long time, the one rule I tell them, and we build around it, is sit on your hands. Right. Mm. So you're so used to getting in there with your hands and solving everything and just doing that. So when you see a problem, your job is to sit on your hands, i.e. don't go do it, but talk to your team about how it's going to happen, which may mean you're not solving the problem. Right. But if you just go fix it and then you just go fix it and then you just go fix it, Lori, to your right, you're going to run out of steam. But two, even more devastating is one, model what a manager is. That's huge. Two, you actually remove the capability of your team to solve problems on their own.
It's like parenting, kind of.
You model learned helplessness. All right, you can't fix that. Mm-hmm. You can't fix that. I'll fix that. Versus just being like, it's a problem that you can fix. Come back in 2 days and with three solutions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
You know, it's interesting about that, Charlie. We talk about this in workshops and with people that we coach. Especially with managers who have that sort of fix it bent, like that's they're fixers. I had a person that I was coaching at one point in time, and she developed this methodology for dealing with her own fixer mentality. Cause sometimes people come into your office as the leader of the team and they want you to fix it cause they don't know what to do. Right. Mm-hmm. So she would ask three things when somebody would come in and drop a problem on her desk. She would say, do you want me to fix it? Do you want me to coach you or do you just need to vent?
Mm-hmm.
Because if she knew her role, like I just need to vent. Charlie, look, I don't need you to fix this for me, but I got a bitch about it because it is bothering the shit out of me right now. Then, you know, right? Mm-hmm. Hands under the thighs. You don't have to do anything. Just listen. And it stopped her from going into her automatic mode of fixer behavior. So I love that sit on your hands for new managers idea. Just let's start to empower the people around us.
Yeah. Yeah. In a very similar way, I was coaching a client on this last week. It was like, you know, we're also in the modern world of async technology like Teams and things like that. And it's like, okay, here's the other practice for them. When you see something that you think one of your teammates should fix or one of her managers, like the people she managed, fixed, save it, but do not respond until either the end of the day or the next morning. Because if you respond instantly, you have cut out your manager, you have cut out everybody else, and you have alerted the whole team of about a few things you did not intend to. One, you have alerted that you don't trust your manager. That's not good. Right. Two, you have reminded your team that you're the only one that can solve that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Three, you have reminded your team that instead of doing your most high value work, you're sitting here monitoring a channel. So next time you ask them to do
that. Charlie, they were so well intended, those managers.
Yeah. So well intended. Yeah.
They blew all those things they didn't even know they blew.
And yet, because no one told them. Like, that's part of it. No one told you that. And even if you go through MBA school, they're not going to tell you that because they're not going to get into that. You're going to learn a lot about business modeling, right? But not about actually like managing people and letting them solve things. And so it's like, look, in that client business and so many of my clients' businesses, it's like you don't have an urgency-based business. There was no reason you needed to respond to that. You could have waited a half day or a day. And then if that person didn't respond, respond to the manager. Hey, did you see this? Don't answer it. Just, did you see it? And then sort of unfold that. You're still sitting on your hands.
Yeah. So in our HR team, we have business partners, you know, who have clients in the business. And I remind them often to sometimes not immediately respond. Somebody is slacking you with something that appears to be an emergency, or they're repeating something that you've dealt with them before. And I'm like, let that sit for at least 3 hours, right? Don't swoop in, right? And coach them out of that, because just give them a minute. They're having a moment where they're frantically typing. Just let that be a minute. This really isn't an emergency.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so much about what accidental managers can do. Eric, I don't know how much you intended to lean it this way, but again, sitting on your hands can be just pausing to ask the question and give some space between the problem and the solution. Yeah. Right. And so to Lori's point, if someone's coming at you with a lot of urgency and things like that, you can ask the question, hey, feels like there's a lot of urgency that you're applying to this. Where's that coming from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then let them sort it.
Yeah.
Because it might truly be urgent and you just didn't know.
Sure.
But it could be one of those things, to Lori's point, where they're like, oh no, it wasn't that important.
Right.
Or
it's not important now, but it was important 5 minutes ago. What shifted? Let's think about that.
Yeah. And sometimes by the time you check in with them, they're like, oh, never mind. I already took care of it.
I figured it out by myself.
Yep. What? Nice. Okay. Job. Reinforce.
So next time, just don't ask me.
Do that. Well, it's so funny, right? I mean, Charlie said this notion of like player coach managers, that's a new way of doing stuff. Yeah. This notion of instantaneous turnaround is also a new way of doing stuff, right? And granted, I know technology has enabled a lot of things, but it's also complicated a lot of things, especially for situations like this, right? Because some people, they just can't turn it off. Like, I get the question, I got to answer the question, right? So,
especially when someone slacks you and emails you and texts you and then comes to your desk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seriously. See, that's a communication team habit that we can totally get out of, right?
Exactly. Right.
It's like, who, you know, it's like the CC thread from hell, which a lot of organizations have. And what it sounds like, especially if you work in a larger organization, you get like 5 to 15 of these things a day where someone didn't sit down and say, who actually needs to see this? Mm-hmm. And so there are 75 of us that read this just to see if we need to read it.
Right. Who, that's a good use of my time.
That's a good use of time. But the thing about team habits is they are these unconscious agreements that we have with each other about what's okay.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that, right? I mean, it's a good segue. The idea here is that there are three types of team habits that can help you get better and make your team, your work life, everything better. So you said that our teams are the 4 to 8 people that we spend the majority of our times with at work. So what are those three types of habits? Like, where do we start in this framework, Charlie?
Okay, so that's partially my publicist doing a great job of pulling the three most important habits out. There are actually 8, right, that I would want to unpack. But my go-tos are always, you know, meetings, because they're easy to beat up on, belonging, and typically decision-making, right, would be the three that I would go to every time. I know, thanks, Zoom. But if we were to unpack all of them, they are team habits around belonging, decision-making, goal setting and prioritization, planning, communication, coordination or collaboration, meetings, and then what I call your core team habits, which are the personal effectiveness habits we all together decide to do as a team. Mm. So that one's the most awkwardly named them, But it's like, imagine that Eric, Lori, and Ruby and I all figure out, like, wait a second, we're Monday morning planners. That's just natively what we do. We show up to work and we plan on Monday morning. What happens when we decide as a team to do that together? Not necessarily we do our planning in real time, but we acknowledge that as a team, the first 3 hours of Monday morning are just set aside so we can do our planning, right? And then we don't have meetings, we don't talk about it. So that way we don't have that 9 o'clock in the morning meeting that subverts our planning, and we use the meeting to figure out what we would be doing during our planning. And so it's just those type of core team habits of what can we do together? How can we show our work to each other better? Something we all need to do. How can we shoot, move, communicate, which is a military sort of thing, which is my background, but how do we take an action, like move forward on a project, and then tell people we took that action so that they know what's going on? Very simple practices. And so, Eric, that's the thing that I want to sort of slide out here too. All of the team habits that we're going to talk about today are very simple practices. They're not rocket science. They're not hard to understand. But I call them rocket practice because they're hard to practice together. That's where the difficulty is. I love it.
Yep.
Right. And so if I say something like, oh, yeah, you can start, you can end a meeting with 5 minutes at the end where you just capture next actions from the meeting and assign ownership of those next action. Like, there are a lot of people who are like, duh, Charlie. And then I'm like, okay.
How often do you do it? Yeah.
And they're like, well, see what happened was. And I'm like, no. Right. Are you doing that thing? And that's where the difficulty is. And that, I think, is the huge opportunity for whether they're accidental managers or anyone, is that we don't need a new budget. We don't need to do a whole bunch of different things. We can just say, you know what? We end every meeting and it's, we feel good. But then 30 minutes later, no one knows what the hell's going on. Well, the one team habit that we can do is just say who's doing the task. And also we can fire somebody, meaning, you know, a Charlieism that I have here is somebody never does anything. When you look at a lot of team tasks, it's like, oh yeah, we need to do that, or somebody needs to do that. And you end up and it's like a bunch of, we need to do that, or somebody needs to do something. Mm-hmm. Somebody never does anything, right? They need to be fired. Specific people do specific things, right? So who owns that thing? Even if they just own the question, they don't have to own the solution. Just who is our person that is going to be responsible to make sure it doesn't fall off the map? And then we talk again next week. And the conversation is, well, what happened from the thing we talked about last time? And everybody's like, I don't know. Let's relitigate it and talk about it again. Again, small things that we can fix, right, along the way that will make our life better.
And I mean, if you give it to somebody, you might as well give it to employee number 48.
Who's sitting on the broken printer.
Yep. What were you about to say, Lori?
I noticed like the whole assigning of accountability. A lot of times it depends, right? It might be your home core team, or it might be a working group or something. And that topic will come up, like who's going to own this. And sometimes the facilitator of that meeting, or sometimes it's the leader, they feel like it's uncomfortable. And so they do the whole, well, we can come back to that, but they don't. And so I encourage people to let there be a big, giant, uncomfortable silence, because somebody will go, all right, I got it. I'll do this. I'll take the thing. Right. And you don't have to point to anybody. You don't have, right. But you just take 5 seconds of silence. Usually somebody will say, I'll do that. I got that. And then move on, right?
Yeah. And it's done. So that is one of those things to where, again, going back to if we take the manager or leader's perspective, right? They so try to avoid that discomfort in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That they overtalk and they overpromise, right? So, and, you know, instead of saying when someone brings them some sort of problem and saying, it's like, I don't know that that's my problem yet.
Yeah.
And just letting that linger.
Yep.
Right? In that discomfort. And someone's like, oh, well, maybe it is mine. Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Right. And or the person needs to explain why it's your problem. And then in that, they might actually be right or they might be wrong. Mm-hmm. Right. But those discomforts, like, I think we have confused psychological safety and comfort. And it's really harming a lot of teams.
Say more about that.
Yeah. Say more about that.
Well, you can have a psychologically safe team where those awkward, uncomfortable moments can exist. And sometimes they're surfaced, right? And a team may be like, ooh, that's uncomfortable. Or, you know, this is awkward, but I'm going to lean into it and so on and so forth. But because we put those together, It's just one of those simple conflations. We get to the point to where we can't do simple things. Actually, I need to pause here and unpack this. So let's talk about the three dimensions of power in any organization. Yeah. So the problem is so much of work conversations focus on two of those dimensions and leave off the third. Okay. So, and this will sound very familiar for people who wrote me, we, right?
fantastic book.
So fantastic book, highly recommend it. So let's talk about personal power, which is the first, which is power two. And that's the power that Charlie, Eric, Lori, and Ruby have just because of our skill set, our knowledge, just what we can push on along. So that's power two. On the other end of the spectrum, we have institutional power. And that's power over. That's the power I have by virtue of my role in the company or my manager. I usually have power over people, projects, budgets, you know, stuff, whatever it is. So many of the problems at work, especially in teams, are just because we try to resolve them with those two dimensions of power. So it's either Eric's problem to fix the printer or it's the manager's problem to fix the printer. Mm-hmm. The thing about it is, and I'll say this before I introduce the third, when you choose the paradigm, you reinforce the paradigm. When you choose the paradigm, you reinforce the paradigm. So every time to the conversation we've been talking about, every time that manager just jumps in and fixes that problem and uses their institution of power, they reinforce that paradigm that that's how things get solved. Mm-hmm. Okay. So now the third dimension of power that I think is the one that's the most powerful and underused, which is interpersonal power. This is power with. Mm-hmm. This is what Charlie, Eric, Lori, and Ruby can do together that none of us could do alone, but we also don't need institutional power to do it.
Right.
Right. Now, what's important when we think about this is, should the team leader decide to do this, they could remember that they are also part of the interpersonal power matrix. Right. And so instead of it just being one of those things to where they are accepted from that and somehow outside of the team, they can lean into the interpersonal dynamics that makes relationships work and say things that humans say, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's right.
The courage to be vulnerable.
The courage to be vulnerable.
I don't have the answer here.
Right. Yeah. I don't have the answer here. Or I'm sorry, I messed that up. Because there are humans and part of this and their team can catch them and they can lean into that. Instead of building up the armor to where if they do something wrong, they have to prove why it wasn't. And then people are not heard, which only reinforces that paradigm.
Yeah.
And so my point with this is so many of these things, like if we have a terrible meeting, we, Charlie, Eric, Lori, and Ruby, we can come together and say, that didn't work, y'all. Like, yeah, what are we doing sucked. Here? This is just our meeting against us four. And it doesn't matter who's the manager. Right.
Do not recommend.
Right. But going back to the difference between psychological safety and discomfort, right? Eric might be able to come to Charlie and be like, hey, Charlie, I know you mean well, but you're really over talking during the meetings. I know you're just excited. Right. Here's the effect that's having that you might not know about. And we can have that conversation, which would be incredibly uncomfortable for both people. And yet we can do that because we have the high belonging and psychological safety that I remember. This is Eric. I know Eric. He's got my back. I got his back. Like, how can we approach this in an interpersonal way?
Yeah.
And it could be that Eric is the manager.
Yeah.
It could also be that Charlie is the manager.
Yep.
Right?
That's a hard conversation to have with my manager, Charlie.
It's a hard conversation to have when you choose institutional power as the vector.
I was just going to say, if you choose the interpersonal paradigm, I like how you said that, it opens up that possibility.
It opens up that possibility. And if I practice that, so when we talk about culture, which is really what we're talking about, we're just talking about it, team habits and team culture. When we collectively decide to practice this way, that means in that conversation with Eric and Charlie, Charlie can't opt out without being out of integrity.
Right.
I got to be in the conversation too.
Right.
So I have to be able to hear that, because that's what it means to be in this type of team that we are co-creating with each other, because it's not just about the manager. Mm-hmm. This is our team.
Yeah.
So
I think to set that up, the leader has to have the self-awareness to go first a lot by asking for feedback, right? Like, I don't feel like that meeting went very well. How, you know, what could I have done differently there? The leader has to step into that space more than once for people to really trust that it's safe to give that person feedback. And then if I argue with the feedback I'm given and make excuses for it, right, then you're done, right? You just say, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
You've given me important things to think about. Thank you.
Yeah.
Because if you argue with people's feedback, they'll stop giving it to you.
Yeah. Or, I mean, and I know this takes high EQ, which is partially what we're talking about here. Or you can say, I'm going to ask for feedback. If you see me blush or turn red or get defensive, it's me reacting to it, and I'm working on that. It's not about you.
Exactly.
It's about me, right? But let's talk about team habits, right? Mm-hmm. Because where did we decide collectively as a team that the manager facilitates team meetings?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Why is that a given? It doesn't have to be. And so what I say is, so many people who are like, oh, my meetings suck, but my manager will never do anything. Well, probably what they're doing, because I've seen this enough, is they're saying, this meeting is not working for me. Manager, you fix it. Mm-hmm. Right. Instead of saying, hey, this is how this is impacting me. Like, I think others might be feeling this way. I have some ideas. Are you okay if I facilitate and run the meeting and I own the change? Mm-hmm. If it doesn't work, it's on me. Right. But if it does work, it's something that you allow. There's a win-win here. And it might be that the meetings are terrible because you have an introverted, insecure manager or leader who's been had this thrust upon them and would rather not be there. Mm-hmm. Right. But is completely open with somebody else running that and doing that. And it takes another thing off of their plate, right? Mm-hmm. So again, there are all of these norms that lie under malperforming teams that if you just build the muscle, the meta muscle that I want teams to do is to really build the meta muscle of changing their team habits. So like if you see something is not working, in which sort of domain is it? It's one way of thinking about it, or just have the conversation like that thing that we just tried didn't work. Mm-hmm. Let's do something different. And I realize I come from a military background, which confuses people because people think military backgrounds are very hierarchical and institutional. And that's just the way it is. But if you've ever served, you realized how collaborative it actually is. Mm-hmm. Right. Because the leaders are going to be like, yeah, no, that didn't work. We wasted too much time. Right. It didn't go as planned. Like, what are your solutions for making it better? And you're going to co-create that as opposed to them just being like, do it this way. Mm-hmm. Right. And so we can do that together should we choose to do that together. Right. And that includes managers and leaders, but also that includes individual contributors to actually step up and do things that may not be their job, right? So that they can make their life and their team life, their team's life better.
So many things, so many things I want to ask about. I'm looking at the time and I'm like, we only have like, you know, 5 or more minutes to talk. And I'm already thinking about when can we get Charlie back here to get even deeper.
Hey, bring it back home.
You have this framework, and there are these 8 sort of bases of habits. If you're passing somebody in an airport and they go, hey, Charlie, my team sucks. Give me one pearl of wisdom. What's one thing I can go do to make my team better? What would you give that person?
Probably what they wouldn't expect.
Okay. Love it.
Focus on building belonging first.
Why is belonging so important?
Because it turns out that you can have a team that performs well, you can have a team that performs without belonging.
Sure.
You cannot have a high performing team without high belonging. It's that missing piece. Mm-hmm. Right. And because when we look at belonging, we think of things like psychological safety, we think of trust. There's a matrix of things that go into belonging.
Sure.
if your team doesn't feel aligned and committed to solving problems together, they don't feel like they belong, they don't feel like they're appreciated, they don't feel like they're respected, everything, every bump, every friction point that your team comes up with is going to be ham-fisted or just a point of dissension and despair and, you know, running at each other with knives. However, you remember and you build the muscle and you build the awareness that this team that sometimes you complain about is Charlie and Eric and Lori and Ruby, people you like, people you know. Like, we don't fight with people we love too much. Sometimes family members, but that's another matter. But
that's a different story.
That's a different story. But even then, it's loving fights, right? But we don't do that, right? We don't pick a model of conflict with people that we have belonging with. So you will automatically be able to start empowering the team to solve problems on its own. Whereas if you just focus on a tighter meeting agenda, okay, you can do that. After the meeting, whenever something messed up happened, what's going to happen is you have that meeting and then you have the commiseration meeting with a couple people who have belonging that talk about the bullshit that happened at the meeting.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So for instance, by the way, if you're not focusing on DEI and inclusion and things like that, understand that every meeting you have has one of those follow-on meetings about the people or from the people who are marginalized that feel the trust to do that. So you're already paying for it.
Yeah.
Right. It's just whether you decide to have the conversation with the full team or whether you have this additional emotional and social labor that's happening outside of those meetings to address the nonsense that happened during the meeting.
Yeah.
So that's why I would say,
I love that you said you're already paying for it. That is gold right there.
Yeah. So speaking of a part two, right, that nugget about belonging, the high trust relationships, the inclusion, the all of those things, doing that in our, you know, new normal, I'll put their quotes around it, right, where so much of things are hybrid. And you know, some teams are all virtual. Some teams are all in person. Most of the teams are a mixture of both. And you've got people that have known each other for 15 years. And then you got the people that were hired during COVID and have been to the office twice. And that is a high burden on a leader to figure out the magic sauce of belonging in those kinds of dynamics. So that, I mean, I think that's, I see that as something that our leaders are still wrestling with is how do I make sure everyone's seen and heard and involved and appreciated and trusted? And am I spending enough time? And so that it's a tall order for a leader to figure out that puzzle.
Yeah. Luckily, the leader is not the only person to figure it out. So
I love that. It's like, don't carry that around yourself.
Don't carry that around because, I mean, in every good, healthy organization, there is cross-sharing of information because people have built other relationships. And so if you make a decision, if you actually build those relationships and you're about to do something dumb, someone on your team might be like, hey, you know, we might go to Eric and be like, hey, you know, Eric, I know you're thinking about letting Charlie go because of his bad performance. His dad died 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Yikes. Didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a whole different thing, right?
Yeah.
Well, why didn't he tell me? Well, he didn't know. Like, he was worried he might lose his job and things like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
That makes a difference. But what if we could share things like that in our team without fear of reprisal?
Right.
It makes a difference because not only, you know, I talk about it in the chapter of Core Team Habits, where one of the things I want teammates to do is learn how to support their other teammates when those teammates fall down.
Yeah.
Because you're going to have your turn, turns out, right?
Yeah.
It might not be your dad dying. There's something is going to happen to you and it's going to be your turn to need support.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so what if we turned it from, well, that teammate's just falling down and we got to do it. It's like, no, it's that turn. It's our turn to help that teammate because it's their turn.
Mm-hmm.
My turn is going to come.
Yeah.
And when it's my turn, not only is it going to be there, but I have to practice receiving that help because if I don't, I break the entire model.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. We have to do this together. And so, yes, right. It does take extra time. And to Lori's point, it's a big burden for the leader should the leader use an institutional power paradigm.
Right.
Right. The trick with hybrid is we have to virtualize the very physical touch points that allowed us to be human in the office. So when I gave Lori, you know, when I asked Lori, hey, you know, what do you want for coffee, or do you want your normal for coffee? And then I go and get it because I know her preferences. And then I hand her that coffee and I can see, hey, she's like, how's her day? And we have those little bitty chit chat moments.
Yep.
Those are the things that build belonging.
That's right.
We have to figure out other ways to do that same thing.
Yep.
Right. Be like, hey, you know, maybe instead of the coffee thing, because that's not relevant, maybe we develop a habit of sharing the song that's on our mind today.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because it will do that. It will have that same point of having that touch point. And it's like, hey, Lori, like, these songs are really sad. Like, are you just really into sad songs, or is there something going on? It's like, oh no, well, this is what happens. Right. Or she could just be that's her jam is,
right. Yeah.
Right. So
we
have to do that as teams. Yeah. And if you empower your teams to do that, and you build, to use the other model, the teams of teams, it turns out you don't have to have an ultimately scaling model for how to build belonging.
Mm-hmm.
You just need a bunch of teams of 4 to 8 people to figure out how they're going to be good humans with each other.
I love that.
And if you do that,
just be a good human.
it's like the book that Lori and I keep threatening to write, management book called Don't Be a Dick. It's one page long, and the one page says, don't be a dick.
And it's one of those things, you know it when you see it.
That's right.
Just like the Supreme Court's definition of pornography, you know it when you see it. I know we're running
tight
on
time, everybody. I'm going to have to fill out paperwork for that. I know it. Damn it. I blame you.
I know we're running tight on time. I do want to allow people to ask Charlie questions. I know we're scheduling a round two because there is so much to get into here. So before I move us into the program close, what questions do you have for Charlie here based on the conversations that we've had today? Ruby put herself on mute to keep herself from going first. Oh, Mark's off mute. What you got, Mark?
Well, I think the key question is, how do organizations realize that they fall into this type of trap? I mean, you know, it's no one likes to be told they have an ugly baby, but there are some cases. So how do you find those companies that say, yes, we do have a problem?
At the organizational level, because it's comfortable, Mark, I typically will diagnose it based upon performance. And so when you look at those 8 categories that I talked about, like if you look at those are the necessary conditions for a high performing team. And so they typically say our teams are not performing well. What's going on? And then I'll work back through that, like, okay, first off, we are not going to start by axing people because I'm not sure that we have a people and individuals problem yet.
Mm-hmm.
We probably have organizational workways and team habits problem yet. And so I would just start working backwards of like, what's not working? Thanks, Ruby. Like, what's not working? Like, our meeting culture sucks. Okay. Well, what that means is we have meeting habits that teams have that are being replicated across the organization. Let's just focus on that. And I didn't talk a lot about meetings today, Mark, but what makes meetings such the whipping boy is that it's the one context in which all the other team habits operate in an hour. You can see all of your team's behaviors in an hour, and it's either great or terrible. And it's a lot that's happening right now. So that's why I get so much love, is because you see so many bad team habits happen. So if you have a high EQ organization, they will actually talk about morale and wellness and, you know, belonging and things like that. But usually, somebody's dropping the ball. They've tried to fix it a few times and they don't know what's going on. And then we can unpack it that, like, you know, turns out humans love caring. They love getting things done. They love working with each other. And most people are doing their best. If we have those 3 assumptions, which are pretty assumptions, then we have systems problems that we need to fix. Are they organizational workways? So you basically created a game that people can't win. Some do that. Hyper-competitive organizations will sometimes create games that humans can't win. Or is it just a lot of these unconscious agreements that we have about how we show up with each other that we can start working through? And then it's, which is the most painful broken printer? And let's start there.
Gotta love it.
Does that help, Mark?
Thank you.
I love it. We got the broken printer. Employee number 48. We've got sit on your hands. We've got somebody never does anything.
That's great.
We got every time you choose the paradigm, you reinforce the paradigm. So many nuggets. This has been, I can say it, and Lori, I'll say it in the intro when I produce this episode. This has been my favorite conversation of 2024.
Yes, one of one.
Charlie, we are doing round two, and we're doing it soon because there's so much to get into here. But I want to get people who are listening to get into your book. Where do they find out more about you? Where do they get the book?
Well, first off, thanks so much for having me. It's been a delight, and I look forward to part two and whatever parts might happen after that. So if you like this conversation, you want to learn more about Team Habits, you can go to betterteamhabits.com. There you'll be able to find out how to get the book, but also, you know, like any good author, all the other things you didn't get to put in the book. So that's where I'm doing that, at betterteamhabits.com. Best place to find me. If you happen to be on LinkedIn, I'm also there with Charlie Gilkey, with, you know, last name G-I-L-K-E-Y. Yeah, that's what I would say there.
I love it. Charlie, thank you so much. This has been fantastic. I am a big Charlie Gilkey fan. I'm looking forward to continuing this conversation. Thank you for being with us today. We are going to get into our end of show ritual, which I always tell our guests, you're welcome to stick around for. But if you got real shit to do and families to get to, you're welcome to do that, because I know it's getting late in the day. We're going to start with our funny things. This is January edition. Funny thing number one, January 1st, January 56th. And that's two pictures there. That's Macklemore and Toby from The Office. This one made me laugh. When you see me at work and I say I'm living the dream, this is actually the dream that I'm referring to.
That's a bad dream.
Here's a bad team habit. Charlie will appreciate this one. When I sign an email yours, it's not a term of endearment. It means this email is now yours. I am done with it. Get it away from me.
Solid. And I love how they articulated the team habit. Bonus points.
You know, Lori, I think about this quite often. Today I learned that the average American drops 80 to 90 curse words a day. It's about 5 an hour. Today I also learned that I'm above average in something.
Winning.
This one is for Morag. It is a British Monty Python joke. Here she's coming on camera for her own joke. People are always amazed at the skilled tattoo artists in Spain, Morag. No one expects the Spanish ink precision. There it is. All right. And my favorite funny thing today, someone in real life on the internet, I don't know, someone told me a story who reads AF as foretold, as in, this taco is spicy AF, should be read as, this taco is spicy as foretold. It's like Morag has her alternate uses for WTF. What's your favorite WTF alternate info?
Wow, that's fabulous.
I was more akin to, why the face?
It's the accent.
It is. Well, that's fabulous. I love it.
We have one for you.
Oh, go, Mariah, go. What you got?
Where's the food truck?
Where's the food truck? Heyo! I love it. All right, today's good feel story. It's a good feel story. It's Steve Hartman. He's going to pull at your strings. Here he goes.
Finally, tonight, CBS's Steve Hartman goes on the road with a story that shows it's never too late to go home again.
At the age of 97.
Good morning.
Just stepping out of a 4x4 is a major accomplishment. But Opal Lee has taken much greater strides than this, with no plans to sit anytime soon.
Where do we go from here?
We don't have to sit around and wait for the Lord to come for us. In fact, he's going to have to catch me.
Opal is a retired teacher and lifelong community activist in Fort Worth, Texas. She's mostly known for her successful campaign to make Juneteenth a national holiday. But what is lesser known is how that fire in her belly came to be. Back in 1939, when Opal was 12, her family moved into a house that stood right here in an all-white neighborhood. They'd lived here just 5 days when a mob showed up.
What did the mob do to your house?
They tore it asunder. They set stuff on fire. They did despicable things.
The family moved away and moved on. They just wanted to forget the horror. Until 8 decades later, when Opal Lee decided the time had come to remember it. So she looked up the address, found out the lot was still vacant and owned by the local chapter of Habitat for Humanity. CEO Gage Yeager took Opal's call. He listened to her story, but then told her she could not buy that property.
Said, well, we won't sell it to you, Opal, but we'll give it to you. There's no option for anything else.
What'd you think when you heard that?
When I get happy, I want to do a holy dance, but the kids say I'm twerking, so I don't ever do it.
And she still hadn't heard the best news.
How are you?
Gage also offered to work with donors to put a house on her land for free.
And so it'll be a 3-bedroom.
Plans are done, and he hopes to have it ready for Opal to move in by her 99th birthday.
I want you to know that I've got a God who has been so good to me. I think if I ask, he'd let me have a couple of more years.
Request submitted.
Fast track.
Steve Hartman, yeah. On the road in Fort Worth.
Great story, right? Steve Hartman, always with the stories that
you have
pull
the
your
heart. Coolest job ever, Steve.
Right? I know. And, you know, We're entering an election year, and my faith in humanity is about to be tested, so I need a lot of Steve Hartman in my life right now.
That's right.
Today's semi-quarantine cocktail is not called Moose Lick. That was last week. Bad quality control, Eric. This one is called Cat Crazy, and it's a riff on the Cheshire Cat cocktail. You need a little bit of cherry vodka. One cat on a stairwell, and you can see his picture there. He's one of those Mr. Bigglesworth cats with no fur. You're going to need some blue Curacao. This dude got a set of car accident injuries. Strawberry vodka. The cat attacked on the stairs. Dude suffered a fractured skull, broken neck, fractured spine, cracked ribs, and blood in his lungs because of that little hairless son of a bitch.
Wow.
Little bit of grenadine. Yes, this reaffirms our fears. Your cat will kill you, but we love them anyway. A little bit of Sprite, and hey, you know what? Life is all about risk. It's all about risk. It's all about stories, and it's all about cool people that we know, like Charlie Gilkey. This has been a fantastic episode. You guys are great. I love each and every one of you. We'll see you next week. Go have some dinner.
Thank you so much for joining us today. If you had a good time and learned a thing or two at today's happy hour, please share it with your friends. If you want to join our tribe, head on over to skyteam.cloud/TCB or email us at info@skyteam.com. That's SKYE team.com. Thanks again, and remember, you've always got friends at the Corporate Bartender.